Hello, I'm Kenny Linden with Radio Free Palmer, and it's my pleasure to welcome candidate for the Alaska Legislature, Eileen Patterson.
Hi, Kenny. Hi, everybody.
Yeah, thank you for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we start diving into our questions, please let our listeners know what district you're running for and give us a brief synopsis of why you're running.
Sure. So I am running for the Alaska State House, District 11, which is the Greater Palmer Area Gateway, a little sliver of Wasilla that goes up to Seward Meridian. And I'm running because 3 years ago, I joined a nonprofit board called Valley Charities, and we started the only reentry coalition in the entire valley. And reentry, for those who aren't familiar, are the series of programs that helps people who have served their time and paid their debt to society while incarcerated and when they're trying to come out, the programs that help them reintegrate. And then 2 years ago, I joined the Matsu Opioid Task Force, which is a local task force trying to help combat the opioid epidemic, which we believe is the root cause for a lot of our crime problems. So in those two advocacy roles, I ran into a lot of political barriers, and we reached out to our legislators to help inform them, educate them, and get their buy-in on some of this and some of our initiatives. And there's just one legislator, my legislator, who never came to anything, and I just thought that was unacceptable and we could do better. So after trying to get somebody else to run unsuccessfully, because who wants to be in politics these days? But I decided to step up and do it myself.
Great. Thank you. So a little bit of context of our questions. Both nationally and here in Alaska, there's developed an increasing political polarization resulting in a lot of gridlock. Excuse me. How do you view the present functioning of state government? What is your approach to working with others of different perspectives to ensure quality government?
This is an important question. I always thought from just kind of looking outside in politics that it become more and more partisan as I've gotten older. And I think that that's to the detriment of the country. People are, you know, this identity politics and wanting to score emotional wins for their team has resulted in a lot of gridlock, as you said. And but now, even now more so when I'm in it and I'm more involved, I'm seeing it's even worse than I thought, which is disheartening. So I'm what you would call a postpartisan Democrat. I believe that relationships are just as important as convictions. I believe in bipartisanship strongly. I'm a champion of bipartisanship. And I'm looking forward to getting to Juneau and to help try and spread some of that positivity, solutions focus, and try and maybe wear down some of these barriers that we have with this like team mentality.
I'm curious. So currently in the House, we have a bipartisan coalition that is the majority. Is that something that you would be interested in joining?
Or? Absolutely. And to take it a step further, which might make some of my Democratic friends a little surprised, but I would join the majority coalition regardless of who the actual majority is. I just think that makes sense. I mean, you get more staff, you more resources that you're joining. I mean, if you're playing Survivor, you go with the numbers. You know, that's just makes sense. So I would do that regardless.
How do you see that we're currently working within the legislature? So you mentioned that you would join the majority coalition no matter what party is in charge. How do you think it's working right now? Do you see room for improvement, maybe, or is it working well for our constituents?
Always room for improvement. And to be honest, I wouldn't be able to say for sure how it's working without being in the room and seeing how these relationships are working out and to kind of, like behind the scenes knowledge. But when you're looking at the bills that have come out, or, I mean, like I was really impressed with HB 312 that just came out last session. So, and that seemed like it was this bipartisan effort to fix one of the problems of SB 91, which is the notorious catch and release. So HB 312 fixed the mandatory release hole that SB 91 created and also made it so that you can look at out-of-state violations or out-of-state convictions when looking at the risk management tool.
Great. Thank you. Moving on to our next question. How would you describe ethics in government and the money often connected to issues? What would you specifically do to ensure an ethical atmosphere? Do you support clean election laws like they have in several other states where candidates raise small amounts of money with petition gathering and get it matched with public funds?
I love this question. Yes, I absolutely believe in campaign finance reform. It's one of my, even though I'm a state candidate, and this is more of a national topic. I don't take any PAC money at all, and that includes from unions and from other groups that maybe more might be more traditionally like left-leaning groups. I do believe that we should have, you know, publicly funded elections. I believe in ranked choice voting. I believe in getting rid of, you know, publicly funding private organization primaries. So I think that there's a lot of room for improvement with elections to make them more fair and not so influenced by big money.
How are you finding, is this your first time running for an elected office?
It is. I threw my hat in the ring for the Mat-Su Planning Commission and was appointed. But yes, that obviously was not an election and was a lot more of a painless process. And not to say that this has been all painful. I mean, there have definitely been some frustrations and some moments of sadness. But for the most part, by and large, this has been a really fun experience. And I'm glad I'm doing it.
What sort of things do you think that the legislature could do to really step into that place of ethical campaign finance reform? So I know on a national level, on a federal level, we have Citizens United is the right. The law of the land from the Supreme Court case.
Unfortunately.
What do you think that we could do from a state perspective to really combat that on the ground?
Well, honestly, I look at it as more of a grassroots. So kind of flip that question. It's not so much what the legislator would do. It's more what we can demand as citizens from our legislators. And then our legislators can take the bold move of modeling correct behavior. So modeling ethics with their campaign finances, being more transparent. But honestly, that there's not a lot of incentive for legislators to do that or candidates to do that. So it more has to be from increased engagement from citizens and from them demanding it and saying that it means something to them. I'm actually a little surprised that my pledge to not take any PAC money has for the most part seemed like it wasn't interesting to a lot of the people that I'm knocking doors and talking to. So I'm not sure that it's clear to the broader population just how much big money influences politics.
Do you think that also kind of plays into, I know there's been a lot of concern or talk about per diem costs as well for legislators during post-session. So when the session down in Juneau doesn't meet those 90 days or sometimes even 120 days and keeps moving on into the year. There have been a few legislators that have stepped up and said that they wouldn't take per diem or that would try to limit the number of days that legislators are in session. Is that something that you are interested in or have worked towards?
Sure, I do. I think trying to hold our legislators accountable is always worth looking at and worth looking at ideas to accomplish. For example, even I have an idea of day one when I'm in the legislature to try and draft a what I call my FaceTime bill. And what that would do was it would require state and local officials to spend a minimum of 40 hours a year, so like one working week out of the year, with face-to-face time opportunities with their constituents. Like, so in accordance with the Open Meetings Act, you know, giving advance notice, you know, so making sure that they aren't just reserving their face time for donors. And so being able to get a better idea of how they can represent their people more authentically.
Yeah. Along those lines, so you've talked about the process of campaigning and knocking doors and having that face time with constituents and some of your background as well. What kind of working relationship do you have with either do you have any with other legislators?
Yes.
Or do you have them with other elected officials in your constituency? Or could you speak to that a bit?
Yes, thank you. So I am actually kind of a super fan of Senator Shelley Hughes. I really admire her engagement. And that's something that I've told her in person several times. When I see her out in the community, which is frequently, you know, we always connect and have a quick chat. When she does her little coffee conversations at Vagabonds, I attend those. She streams live on Facebook when she's in session, and that's something that I would do as well. I think that that's something every legislator should do. It's just such a simple tool and a way to engage our communities better. So Senator Hughes is someone I have a good working relationship with. Senator David Wilson's another one who I see all the time. He comes to all the summits, like for the wellness prevention and things like that. And so I admire him and his engagement. And maybe a bit of a surprise is Representative Eastman. He's another one who I feel like is just really engaged. And so I engage with him. And even though we disagree on many things, we respect each other's engagement and willingness to show up for the people. So and then Representative Kathy Tilton, she's another one who comes to a lot of the meetings, public hearings, things like that. She's very visible and accessible. So because I've been in the community, I've been trying to, like I said before in the beginning, you know, make relationships with these legislators to advocate for recovery. So I have made those relationships, and I think that it will serve me well in Juneau.
Great. Moving into our next question, in your view, what are the most serious environmental problems that need to be addressed? What do you see as the state's role in finding a solution to those problems?
Oh, it's complicated. So I'm not an expert in like renewable energy and climate change. I mean, I do believe in the, you know, anthropologic climate change and that, you know, humans need to do what they can to mitigate the damages that we're causing. I would lean heavily on climate scientists and experts and listen to what their recommendations are for things that we can do or, you know, draw our attention to glaring problems. So I would lean on those experts and do more research, to be honest.
Do you know of any specific issues that have come up within your district or looking more on the state as a whole?
Well, I mean, I've heard about, you know, the wood smoke, wood burning, you know, the stove. And mostly what I've heard, though, is from concerned citizens that it's going to some, you know, any restrictions or regulations would interfere with their daily lives.
Fairbanks has done recently as well.
Yes. So the same kind of thing like out in the Butte. And so I obviously, as a legislator, you have a responsibility to hear the complaints or the concerns of your citizens. But then you also have the responsibility to lead and to present the logical arguments, to present the data and the evidence to your constituents and say, well, this is why we're doing it this way. And, you know, I hear you, you know, but this is the persuasive argument, you know. So I think that you have to be able to do both.
Are you hearing any concerns from constituents specifically around environmental pieces here in the state?
Sure. I think especially because there is so much doubt about it, and you hear the doubt that there's anything really to be concerned about, you know, that there are more pressing issues. And I recently watched this really interesting video about why that is, about why human beings tend to not worry so much about climate change. And it was super interesting. And it's on the YouTube. And it was just about how because it seems so far away as a survival instinct, our brains don't want to really process it as something crucial or important because it does just, you know, it just seems so far away.
Hmm. I know we've talked about a few different things, and I'm curious if, especially when it comes to environmental concerns or issues that come up, that usually resource development comes up on the other side of the coin or in conjunction or within the same conversation. Is that Where do you stand when it comes to resource development? I don't know if there's much within your district or if it looking on a state level of how that's balanced or some of the projects that are currently being worked on or spoken about in the future. Do you have any perspective on those?
Well, I think the Alaska State Constitution is beautifully written when it comes to the symbiotic relationship between resource development and conservation. I mean, they can work hand in hand. So I do support resource development as long as, you know, you keep that balance with, you know, conservation and being responsible. as far as right here in the valley, I know one of our greatest natural resources is our soil, our agriculture. We have such great soil out here, and we can really invest in some more agricultural development and really helping the people who are already like our farmers and helping them get connected to buyers. And you know, SB 6 just passed. One of Senator Shelley Hughes, and I give another shout out to her for that bill, which created the legal separation between cannabis and hemp. And so now hemp is a nitrogen horse, so I've just learned this. So our soil is not actually very rich in nitrogen, but there are so many awesome creative solutions that I've heard. Like, so you can take coffee grounds. So, you know, we've got all these little coffee shops, and so that's a whole other industry that could pop up too to help create nitrogen-rich fertilizer, is going around to all these coffee shops and getting their coffee grounds and then creating the nitrogen-rich fertilizer that we need to grow hemp. And then we can invest in agricultural processing to create the 55,000 different products that, you know, you can make from hemp. So, yeah, did that answer the question? I feel like maybe I kind of went around that.
No, that's great. And I'm curious, when it comes to hemp or cannabis production in your district, I know the city of Palmer is within your district, and the city of Palmer has banned the sale of cannabis within city limits. But your district is large, more than just Palmer, so you're outside of city limits as well. Is that something that you would be interested in advocating for, or?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, you know, there are legitimate concerns for the changing character of the town. I don't share those concerns. I think cannabis needs to be something that people learn more about, and the stigma needs to be reduced. We have multiple bars within the city of Palmer where people consume alcohol, and I just don't see any logical reason to keep cannabis out if you're going to have alcohol, you know, served in bars. It's medicinal for a lot of people. I don't know, and we could get into a whole thing about cannabis, but no, I'm pro cannabis, and I would sign any petition, or I would vote for, and I would advocate for allowing cannabis dispensaries within Palmer city limits.
Moving on to our next question, what is your view of the government's role to make sure every Alaskan has access to health care?
It's so important. You know, it's so, so important. And I think the conversation gets lost sometimes when you think about, you know, the government's overreach or the government's too many responsibilities of the government. That's not the responsibility of the government, and it's a private responsibility. But we need to look at the economic impact as well. I mean, that make this an economic conversation. When people have access to health care and they have access to preventive treatment, and they're getting their regular annual checkups and things like that, then they're more productive. They don't miss as much work. They're happier, and it's just, there is a strong economic argument for providing quality health care to Alaskans, and that we should focus on that, especially being in an economic crisis and a bit of a recession. The investment into health, providing quality health care to Alaskans, will reap rewards that we know we can't even measure really right now.
Is that something that you, from your experience with the Matsu Opioid Task Force, is that something that has come up from a healthcare perspective, from access or need or availability?
Yes. So Medicaid expansion is important. You know, a lot of times, you know, people who are in recovery, they can't afford it, or trying to get into recovery, they can't afford it. And so they do lean on government programs to help them get what they need. I actually had a citizen, I might go off a little bit real quick, but I give my phone number to everybody, right? I'm really accessible, and I really want everyone to call me 907-795-6587. It's my personal cell phone number. So a citizen called me recently with an idea and said, what if people who need treatment had to use their PFD to pay for that treatment back? And I was like, and that's something worth fleshing out. I don't know. I don't know the constitutionality of it, or if it's something that we could really do, but it's worth fleshing out. So, but to get back to what you were saying about Medicaid and health access to healthcare, yes, it comes up with the Opioid Task Force, and something that we're trying to advocate for actually is this new FDA-approved device called the Bridge device. It's a neural stimulator that goes on the ear, and it reduces withdrawal symptoms. One of the biggest barriers to recovery for a lot of people is going through withdrawal. And so this device reduces those symptoms dramatically. And so now that it's been approved by the FDA, if Medicaid would cover it and you could get people on Medicaid, then that could reduce that barrier and help more people get into recovery.
I know there's a lot. And that's great. And it's I enjoy all the different avenues that
you can go down.
I'm curious when it comes to the cost. So we talk about it's an economic there's economic reasons to provide healthcare that you've mentioned before. And when it comes to the costs that Alaskans face for especially health insurance, have you spoken to other legislators or have looked at any plans when it comes to trying to reduce that cost of insurance?
Well, yeah, I think incentivizing prevention. Recently, a meme went around our little community about being proud of not going to the doctor unless you're dying. So we maybe have to change the culture a little bit and to get people to understand that adds to the cost burden. If you're only going, when something's a serious issue, then it ends up costing us all more. So incentivizing preventive measures and also, I think we have an opportunity here in Alaska, too, to experiment with some new healthcare models. I talked to a provider whose door I knocked, and she introduced me to this idea of direct primary care membership plans, these cash-based plans with your providers, and if Alaska could help help it so that it would qualify under the Affordable Care Act as insurance so that people wouldn't get dinged or, so they wouldn't have to pay that penalty. So that's something the legislature could do to try and facilitate some of these new ideas for getting health care to citizens at a lower cost.
So moving in that same sort of direction when it comes to cost, there's an increasing pressure on the state's budget, especially the funding of education and health and human services. Other services such as transportation and public safety are also feeling the pressure. How do you see the legislature contributing to solutions?
Well, I think first by stop promising to cut them more. That would be good. We need to invest. I listened to Senator Mike Schauer at a forum, and he was talking about balanced, sustainable budgets and how, if you're a citizen in your own home, then you don't overextend. You take in this much money, you spend that much. But if you're a business owner, I feel like you understand the concept of growth and you understand the concept of investment and getting a return on your investment and getting what you pay for and getting what you put in. And sometimes you have to make investments in things and maybe even overextend or try and raise the money up real quick somehow creatively and make those investments to get the long term.
Essentially like a mortgage for buying a house.
Right. I mean, I don't know many Alaskans who have zero debt, so it's not saying it's something we should strive for, but it's something that we should all understand in concept.
I'm curious with your perspective on different revenue streams. So in the last few years, we've talked a lot about a state income tax or a state sales tax, even reintroducing an education tax. Are those things that you would support or you're interested in?
I'm open to really any idea to help generate more revenue for the state. I believe cutting our PFD was a tax. I mean, that was a tax on Alaskans, and it was a tax. My 2-year-old paying the same amount of tax as a CEO on Hillside in Anchorage, I mean, is the most unfair tax that we could do for Alaska. I would think, a sales tax is a good idea, and an income tax is an even better idea, in my opinion, because you can make it even more fair. But then there's things that we can do also to help generate more revenue, allowing for on-site consumption for the cannabis industry. Right now, we can't really capture any tourist dollars with cannabis because there's no place for them to consume. So if we could do that, then that would generate even more revenue for our state and things like that.
I'm curious when it comes to transportation, public safety are both huge issues within the Matanuskins, Susitna Valleys. I'm sure specifically within your district as well. Are those areas that you've had conversations or interested in? You mentioned that you had been a part of the MATSU Planning Commission. So those are the sorts of kind of big ticket items that we see coming from both the state and maybe the borough as well.
Yeah. So actually, just last meeting of the MATSU Borough Planning Commission, we passed a resolution for the assembly to take a look at this long-term plan, transportation plan. And the Mat-Su Health Foundation was involved. The borough planners were involved. And they created this amazing plan. You can go check it out on the website for the Mat-Su Borough. And so once the assembly adopts that plan, I think it will really help with some of the siloing that we have going on in our borough. We have a lot of these nonprofits and community agencies that are providing transportation services, but they're passing each other. So we found ways to create more efficiencies. And so I'm really looking forward to see that come into play. But it is a big issue, especially with the growth of this borough. We really need to, it's like you said, it's a public safety issue, but then also issues for, you know, our seniors and our young people trying to get to and from places where they can find employment. It's something that we've already looked at and we will continue to look at. And yeah.
Are things like, I know there's been a lot of talk about a commuter rail line, or we've talked about the Kinnick Arm Bridge. Are those sort of transportation projects from the Mat-Su to Anchorage things that you support or are interested in?
Yes,
or are there others?
Yes, so extending the rail up to Palmer. Right now, you know, it ends at the fairgrounds. I think extending it up to Palmer would be amazing, and it shouldn't be that expensive, and not really sure why it hasn't been done yet. So it's something I would look into. Absolutely, the commuter rail. I know I've talked to Mayor Edna DeVries about it. I think she sits on that committee, and she's talked about how when they've looked at it the costs haven't bared out. But I would like to look into that more and look into the details and maybe come up with some creative solutions to how to mitigate or lower some of those costs to make it more feasible.
You've also talked about Senate Bill 91 has been a huge talking point over the last couple of years, and so specifically referring to public safety. And you mentioned HB 312 as being one of those ones that has attempted to reconcile some of the issues that came up. Are there other solutions that you are interested in pursuing, or do you think as is the system's working, or are there other needs within perhaps our correctional system, or what do you see as your role as a legislator to be able to work on?
Well, yeah, this is a really big question because I think it's really hard to sift through the noise. So there's a lot of noise around SB 91 right now, and I did a trooper ride-along with Sergeant Johnson a few weeks back. I have talked to prosecutors. I have, you know, I've been listening to some of the key personnel talk in these forums. And it's hard because there are these partisan biases that you hear. And so you really got to get into the data and look at things. I mean, I know we need our courts open 5 days a week. Right now that's four. I know we need more prosecutors. I know we need more correctional officers. I know that we need more treatment facilities. I know we need more people staffing these pretrial diversion programs. But everything that I'm talking about right now costs money. And so you need to be able to fund these things to make them work. And that's been something I think that across the board, people have agreed that SB 91 was not funded properly enough. Maybe put the cart before the horse a little bit. And so that's why it's kind of perceived as this failure. I think... So like some of those things I mentioned, if we can fund these things and increase our output and increase the investment in some of these programs and opportunities, then we could truly get a better idea of the functionality of SB 91.
Great. I'm also curious when it comes to education. We've talked a lot about education from, I know with the Mat-Su School District, with being able to fully fund or per diem from the state's calculations of how much they give per student. And is that something that do you think we are funding education well, or could there be improvements? Could there be cuts? What is your perspective on that?
I don't know where you would cut. But for me, honestly, it's about reducing classroom sizes. That's first and foremost, which means we need more teachers. And how we get more teachers, recruitment and retention, we need to return back to a defined benefit program. Right now, our retirement benefit packages for our teachers is not enough. It's not good enough. So we need to – that's something immediately that we would have to look at and try and get those classroom sizes smaller.
Great. Thank you so much, Eileen. And again, we were joined by Eileen Patterson, who's running for House District 11 in the Greater Palmer area. And thank you for joining us again today in the studio.
Thank you so much, Kenny. I had fun.
I'm Kenny Linden, and you've been listening to Radio Free Palmer.